Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
One thing I think everybody should have learned after New Hampshire is let's not pay so much attention to polls. You know, we need to let voters actually make up their minds.
Well, pollsters, as Hillary Clinton noted, were definitely not the one after the New Hampshire primary, after most of them saw evidence of Barack Obama cruising to victory just before he lost. Today, two major polls are just out, an ABC News Washington Post poll and a CBS News New York Times poll, with some fairly different conclusions. For example, the Times poll shows Clinton with a big national lead. The Post poll shows Clinton and Obama about even nationwide. Both polls have McCain as the new national frontrunner for the Republicans and Huckabee running second, but Romney has twice as much support in the Post poll as he does in the Times poll. So what does it all mean? Does polling serve a purpose in our democracy in an election season anyway, or does it simply serve to sell newspapers while possibly distorting the race? On our primary election series, Are You the One?, we'll talk now to a leading pollster and sometimes critic of his own business. Mark Blumenthal runs the website pollster.com, which aggregates many different political polls. He was a campaign pollster for 20 years and one of our partners with the Huffington Post in our recent polling project to see what the experience of being polled is like. And Mark, thanks for coming on WNYC. Good morning.
Great to be on with you.
We talk about the polls rarely on this show, I want to tell you, but one of the biggest complaints we get from listeners is that the media is obsessed with polls to the exclusion of the issues, and also that the widespread media dissemination of polls serves to freeze the race, that it will freeze real substantive debate because some candidates or some issue positions are considered marginal from the start because of the polling. Same thing with candidates. How much do you think that's the case, that polling actually freezes or affects rather than just reflects democracy?
I think that's a reasonable criticism. As someone who worked with campaigns for many years, as you mentioned, I can tell you that where the candidates stand in an initial survey does affect their ability to raise money, whether they're running for president or for Congress or for the House of, you know, for State House. And it does make it a little difficult to break out. And I think you'd be hard-pressed not to look at the coverage of the last 6 months to a year and not say that horse race results drove a lot of the coverage. It was awfully hard for Chris Dodd or Joe Biden or even Bill Richardson to get much attention when the focus was on the front runners in the Democratic Party.
And I mentioned the Times and Post polls from today. Those are media polls, and both were their papers' lead stories today.
Right.
And I actually wonder why. What public purpose does that serve on the day before the very important for the Republicans Michigan primary, 5 days before South Carolina for the Republicans, Nevada for the, both parties, and such crucial primaries in all cases? What information do these polls even give the public that helps us in any way know something we need to know that's going on?
Well, I suppose one issue is that we, or that is those of us who pay a lot of attention to politics, want to know. You know, the second most asked question I've gotten via email over the last week, after we get past all the questions about New Hampshire and exit polls and whatnot,
is
where are the polls in Nevada?
Uh-huh.
How come there aren't any more polls in Nevada? Why haven't you updated your site there? There's
right.
A real sort of thirst for what folks in the business call the horse race. I think also if you look
depends,
at these...
Well, it depends, but thirst by who? Now, I'll say that I think, you know, listeners, you can call in on this and say anything you want about the proper place of polling in a democracy, or if there's anything specific about polling or even a particular poll that you've ever wanted to ask a pollster and never had the opportunity. Well, now you have the opportunity because Mark Blumenthal, who runs pollster.com, is here. So call us, 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692, or post a comment to WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehr Show. But when you do, be honest. Do you look at this stuff? Do you eat this stuff up even as quickly as you decry its place in our media and in the campaigns? 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692, or post a comment to WNYC.org, click on Brian Lehr Show. And I'm sorry, Mark, you were going to say
Let me just throw in another observation on this. The polling editor, the polling directors of the Washington Post and ABC News wrote an op-ed that appeared the Sunday before the New Hampshire primary, in which they said, among other things, and they had a lot of worthwhile things to say, that we ought to throttle back on the horse race. Essentially, the point you're making, and I'm not saying that that's wrong, but they've been the most outspoken in saying there's too much horse race, and here you go. 10 days later, front page of the Washington Post is a story all about the horse race in the Democratic and Republican primary. So there's something about the market of people who read news that seem to want this stuff. If we didn't, we wouldn't have it. The other point, if I can go on a little longer,
please,
is that if you look at the two polls in question, you can go online today, hopefully by now go to pollster.com and see the links where you can get very long downloadable documents that have a whole lot more than just the horse race result, that get into how these candidates are perceived, all of them, where they're strong, where they're weak on issues, on their qualifications, on their experience, how Americans are following this race, how they're coming to make their decision. As someone who studies politics and campaigns for a living, I find this information just invaluable. And I think most...
But why is it invaluable? Because why? Because even as you're saying that, I'm thinking, you know, and I admit I gobble them up, but why... I gobble them up as an individual, but I try to use a lot of restraint in how much we talk about them on the
right.
show. And because I think those two roles are different. And I think, well, why are they useful? Why is it useful to me even to know what you just said is a deeper level of analysis, and that is how the candidates are perceived by others, how their positions on the issues are different, rather than just for me to perceive them
right.
and for me to just compare their positions on the issues?
Well, I would say, and I'm sure you know your listeners may well disagree with me on this, and that's fine. If you want to use a poll to decide, well, if your goal is to decide who to support, if you're an uncertain voter and you're trying to make up your mind, don't look at a poll.
Uh-huh.
It's the last place I'd say to look. There's so much more that's worthy and useful. But for the rest of us who focus on politics tend to have our minds made up pretty early in this process, we're trying to understand what everyone else is doing, then I think there's some value there. We all look at election results, and within minutes after the votes are counted, we're arguing with each other about what they mean, what the mandate really was, what the motivations were behind people voting the way they did.
Well, see, those polls to me seem like they play a much more useful and important role. And the exit polls, right? Or in Iowa, they were entrance polls. Because they're asking actual voters
right.
what they actually did or are going to do. And even though they're sometimes wrong, like on the Democratic side in New Hampshire, they're also asking a lot of these opinion questions and trying to discern what the reasons for actually voting actually were, and therefore, as you say, what the mandate was.
Mm-hmm.
So that it seems to me that that plays a very different role than the polls before an election. Do you agree?
To some extent. I mean, if again, take a look at this CBS New York Times poll this morning, some of the first questions. What's more important to you in a presidential candidate, having the right experience or having fresh ideas? What kind of change do you want most? Do you want the next president to bring about? That sort of thing before they get into the vote trial heat results that are on the front page that we're all talking about. And I'll point out, that's what we're all talking about. Even though you can find a lot of those results in that same story, for whatever reason, we're all consumers of this stuff. We tend to focus on the scoreboard. And I think that's just part of the human nature of how those of us who follow politics follow it. We want to know who's ahead and who's behind.
Let's take a call. Carol in Park Slope. You're on WNYC. Hi, Carol.
Good morning. Brian, I just have to tell you that I've listened to you from day one. And I really appreciated your integrity and your ability to take risks.
And I appreciate your listening for so long.
Okay. What I wanted to say were two points. One is that, and I wish I remembered which mayoral election it was in New York, but polls, especially early polls, seem to be able to really influence how the money comes into the candidates and can sometimes actually eliminate really good candidates because of they're not having enough money to keep going.
Right. And I think you were making that point earlier, Mark. Is it possible to measure, and Carol, thanks for your call, what that impact exactly may have been on the kinds of candidates you mentioned, Biden, Dodd, Richardson?
Yes and no. I think political scientists have been studying this for many years. That is, what extent do poll results have on elections? To what extent do they limit? Are they self-fulfilling prophecies sometimes? You can see associations that candidates who are far behind have a harder time raising money than those who are farther ahead. I would say that one of the interesting things about the way politics has progressed over the last couple of years is that it has clearly become possible for presidential candidates who are not at the top of the polls to raise huge amounts of money from individuals on the Internet. The Obama campaign, the Ron Paul campaign, even Huckabee, as he started to get attention in the late summer. I mean, there are ways that are sort of positive around this, but I'm touching your question. One question is, if you come to a race as a candidate and you are well known and you have a base of support, that's an asset. You know, other candidates who are poorly known are going to have to either raise or spend money or do something to make that up. In the presidential campaign, there's kind of a unique circumstance where a little-known candidate like a Huckabee can get some early success and sort of explode onto the national scene. If you're running for Congress, if you're running for state representative, it is very hard to do that. So if you begin the race as someone with a base who has a lot of support, which is what essentially a poll is measuring, that's not insignificant and an important thing to those trying to pick a nominee who's going to be the strongest candidate in a general election.
Let's take another call. David in Harlem. You're on WNYC. Hi, David.
Hi, Brian. How you doing?
All right. How are you?
Okay. I was just talking to your screener. I could go on forever. I just came up from down from New Hampshire from the primaries, and we could do a whole show on that. You were working
for a campaign?
Absolutely. Hillary, of course.
Uh-huh.
That's right.
Okay.
The girl. Exactly. Me and about, maybe six busloads of us went up there. But just to tie it into your poll, your question with respect to the polls. I mean, the polls is extremely accurate at presenting what happens on a daily basis. You had 3,000 Hillary supporters. I had people there from Iowa, Colorado. Not I had, but she did. Philadelphia, like I said, the six busloads of us from New York, mm-hmm. And we knocked on these people's doors. Three, four days in a row. I mean, he had people, and I'm black, and he had people there, 75-year-old women, inviting us into their home. But the one thing that every single person said at the end of the conversation was, we're still undecided, but, you know, we like your candidate, but we're still undecided. And that's something that the polls don't capture, is the culture of the people there. And the people of New Hampshire, and they're fabulous, by the way. I mean, I love them to death. The people in New Hampshire, they hold everything close to the vest, as opposed to people from Iowa who are like, are you telling us to vote this way, press? We're going to vote exactly the opposite way.
Oh, you think that New Hampshireites are different than Iowans in that
Absolutely.
Respect?
Absolutely. New England folks are more close to the vest. And, I mean, the people were so mature and so, you know, into their vote. They were so into the fact that they have such an important aspect of the American voting experience.
Fascinating. David, thank you very much. And Mark Blumenthal from pollster.com, he was really putting two things on the table there. One is the undecided vote and how that is measured and whether that was, you know, part of the problem in measuring the New Hampshire vote. And also he sees different populations as reacting differently to polls published in the media.
Mm-hmm. Let me take the first one because he raises a really good point. And I think he's right, but there were two polls that I know of that did a really good job of measuring that sort of undecided sentiment. It just didn't get covered very much. One was the CBS survey that was done over the weekend right before New Hampshire, on which 28% said on a separate question that their minds could still change. This is among the Democrats. The University of New Hampshire CNN survey asked a question. I loved it. I must have referenced it a dozen times over the course of the fall. Only half of the Democrats said they had definitely decided, and this was as of Saturday, Sunday. 21% said they were still trying to decide, and 26% just leaning. And the exit polls bore that out, that there were something like 18% who decided in the last day and about 30-something who decided over the last 3 days. That was a fundamental difference about New Hampshire that we, meaning the news media, should have done a better job making clear and didn't. And it is something that polls can measure. And that it, and your caller is right, that is something unique about the New Hampshire primary. Typically, voters have their minds pretty much made up by the last 48 hours.
When we continue in a minute, I'm going to play a clip from the ABC This Week roundtable yesterday where a number of prominent Washington journalists were talking about polls and race. And then I want to ask you some of the things that I'm curious about in addition to take some more polls, like how do they use such small samples to measure public opinion in the whole country? What about these push polls? And does polling become less accurate the more people use cell phones in America? So we'll get into some of that stuff. Stay with us. Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Brian Lehrer on WNYC with our Super Duper Tuesday series, Are You the One?, which we will continue until February 5th as the New York, Connecticut, and New Jersey primaries are part of that big crush. And that's really kind of what we're aiming toward, helping to give you as much information as you need to make up your minds in those primaries in our area. Tomorrow, for example, we'll take a close look at Ron Paul libertarianism. And we'll also ask if any of you would ever or have ever crossed over to vote in another party's primary as an act of sabotage. The Daily Coast, as you may know, is urging Democrats and liberals in Michigan, where you can vote in either primary, to vote for Mitt Romney just to further fracture the Republican race because two other people have won the first two. So we'll talk about those things tomorrow, but I also want to tell you that WNYC continues to bring you the major presidential campaign debates. The next two are Democratic debates. Tomorrow night will air what they're calling a black-brown issues debate from Nevada. And then next Monday, Martin Luther King Day, we'll have the Congressional Black Caucus debate among the Democratic hopefuls. So check out all our election coverage at WNYC.org. Click on Vote 2008. We are talking now with pollster Mark Blumenthal. He did campaign polling. He worked four campaigns for 20 years. Now he runs the website pollster.com, which aggregates many different major polls. Now, Mark, I want to play you a clip from the ABC News program This Week yesterday. This is about a minute. George Stephanopoulos asks the panel whether race played a role in the disconnect between the polls and the results in the New Hampshire Democratic primary. And we will hear the responses from E.J. Dion of The Washington Post, Jay Carney of Time Magazine, and Claire Shipman from ABC News.
I take it from what you guys were saying, no one here thinks that there was some sort of secret anti-black vote in New Hampshire that didn't show up in the polls. I don't, but I just want to just.
I didn't see it in the post election analysis of the exit polls. I mean, Barack Obama held steady with the vote count he was supposed to get in the polls, but Clinton surged forward. I think she took a lot of Dodd voters. I think she took a lot of Biden voters disproportionate. I think the undecideds probably broke her way. We didn't see, the black tax.
At the same time, I think we've seen some of Barack's advisors wonder if there's something to that, and our own pollster does not think there was a surge in the female vote for Hillary Clinton and says that's
not
still something
end.
No, and that's something we need to look at. So
I'm suspicious of the race explanation because for two reasons. One is there is no history of deep racial conflict in New Hampshire, partly because it's such a homogeneously white state. You see that effect more in those places. And the question is this more like Tom Bradley in Los Angeles, where you saw it, or Doug Wilder in Virginia, or is it more like the Harold Ford race in Tennessee, where Ford did not underperform from the polls? My hunch is it's more like the Harold Ford examples.
E.J. Dion from The Washington Post, the last voice there. Mark Blumenthal, do you have an opinion on that question?
Oh, I do, and this is one of those things where your caller's right. I could probably go on for an hour about it, so I'll try to be concise. There are a lot of theories about what may have gone wrong in New Hampshire, and I have a lot of thoughts about all of them, one of which is what has been called the Bradley-Wilder effect, that they were that those panelists were talking about. And they have it slightly upside down. What there were a series of polls in the 1980s in Tom Bradley's race for mayor, Doug Wilder's race for governor of Virginia, where the percentage in the pre-election polls for the African-American candidate was about right, but the pre-election polls seemed to have the white candidate too low, which is exactly the pattern, at least, that seems to have been evident in the polls in New Hampshire. My gut hunch, if you just want to ask, you know, speculation, it doesn't feel to me like a race effect. If anything, I think some of the same tension might have been more about gender and age. That is, the reluctance of a over 50, well-educated woman who's leaning to Clinton but might be reluctant to share that with her, with someone who is male or younger, who she presumes to be an Obama supporter.
Who might be
a theory.
Who might be the pollster, in other words.
Right. The theory behind the Wilder-Bradley effect was something that pollsters call social discomfort. Big rule meaning you don't want to say something to a stranger on the phone that you think might embarrass yourself or the person on the other end of the line. So if you think that they're in disagreement and you think that disagreement would cause some tension in the conversation, you might keep your opinion to yourself. I don't think that there was a racial element there. I mean, I could be wrong. There's an outside chance that this had something to do with the gender of the interviewer or the age of the interviewer.
Interesting.
And it could have been any number of other things.
It is interesting how since New Hampshire, race has really broken out as an issue between Clinton and Obama and is making a lot of people both uncomfortable and unhappy about that. And we're going to talk about that in some detail with our next guests in about 5 minutes. But Miriam in Princeton, you're on WNYC with a question about polling. Hi.
Hi. Yeah, I wanted to address the issue of cell phones and polls, and specifically among young people. I mean, I think it applies to everybody, just being, you know, easier to reach, and kind of we are in the age of cell phones now, and it needs to be addressed. But specifically for people under 30 or even 35 who only have cell phones, they're being totally eclipsed from the entire process, and I just don't see how we can take, accept any polls that don't kind of address this new factor in our lives.
Right.
You know?
Mark, can that be addressed?
Let me take it quickly. She's right that it's a problem. She's right that people who are under 30 without a landline phone are being missed by most of the national surveys that do the typical methodology used by national surveys. What they're doing, and that number seems to be in the mid to high teens now that are cell phone only or without a landline phone nationally. What national surveys do is they adjust, they weight by age and by other factors. So what ends up happening is the under 30 respondent with a landline phone is essentially replacing the under 30, the person who should have been sampled who doesn't. Does that create a problem? As long as they tend to have the same attitudes, it doesn't. It didn't seem to matter all that much in 2004. The question's sort of open now, but I'll point this out. Most of those looking at this problem wondered if missing cell phone respondents would hurt Obama, that is, that his vote would be understated. Well, last week, if anything, there was a problem with the choice of the older respondents being understated. So,
interesting.
I'm not sure if that's the critical problem yet. It may well be before the end of the year, if the year is out.
Thank you, Miriam. One thing that's amazing is how small the samples are in these big public polls. For example, the New York Times CBS News poll out today, the Times on page 14, has a fairly substantial box about how the poll was conducted. And it says January 9th through 12th with 1,178 adults throughout the United States. Of these, 1,061 said they were registered to vote. Now, that's 1,000 people representing, what, 100 million who are likely to vote in November?
Right, or something like that. I get uncomfortable calling public opinion polls scientific, even though we all like to fall back on that shorthand. There's a lot more art in a pre-election poll, I think, than there is science. But to the extent that there is science, it is about the science of sampling. If the sample is random, if the respondents are selected truly at random, and if everyone in the country within reason has a chance of being selected, note that may exclude those with cell phones only, then what you have will project out onto the whole population within a certain predictable range, no matter how small that sample is. So something that's 300 or 400, given the margin of sampling error, is as good as a sample 10 times as large that's non-random. If you just grab, if you walked out on the street corner in Manhattan and grabbed 5,000 people and interviewed them, you wouldn't think they'd be very representative of the nation of Hull as a whole, no matter how many you interview. Whereas if you draw a sample using the science of sampling, random sampling,
right,
it can be.
But it's amazing that 1,000 people can stand in, because the sample already reflects probability,
right,
of what 100 million people are going to do. I'll tell you one kind of polling pre-election that I think might be useful to people, and that seems to me to be very hard to get an accurate read on, and that is electability polling. Because in primaries, one of the things that people always look for is, well, I want my party to win, so which candidate is going to do best against whoever the other guys put up? And I noticed that in public opinion polls in general, among Democrats, they say that Clinton is more electable than Edwards or Obama. That's what people believe. But they each claim, the other candidates claim that in other polls, they match up better against Senator Clinton does against Republicans. So that is a potentially useful set of numbers to people if,
right,
if you think it means anything. So so when you do these matchups,
right,
you know, if you call nationwide the same 1,061 people and ask in a theoretical Clinton-Romney matchup, how would you vote? Clinton Giuliani, Clinton McCain, and then do the same, run through,
right,
the same thing,
right,
with Obama and Edwards. Are there meaningful results on those things as far as you know?
Well, there are a bunch of questions in there. The question of, can you ask Americans who is electable and get a response that is meaningful? My opinion, and I'm speaking only for myself here, I hate those questions. When I've been involved in campaigns and we've asked voters, sometimes even in focus groups where we can hear them speak in their own words, who is electable?
Mm-hmm.
Their response is usually, well, the one that's been around politics the most, or the one that,
right,
seems to be ahead.
But again, I think there are two different questions there.
But that's,
and I think
the
media,
you know,
does a very bad job of teasing out this difference in general. It's one thing to ask people what they think other people think.
Right,
which is,
right,
what you were just talking about. Who do you think is electable? Oh,
right,
I think Clinton is more electable.
As opposed to which one is really the strongest?
As opposed to asking people, who would you vote for? Especially asking,
okay,
you know,
in other words, measuring which candidate.
Yes, measuring. I'm putting Clinton up against Romney. Who are you picking?
Right. Well, the only flaw there is that if you do those matchups right now, you have candidates sort of in the mix here, whether it's a Romney or a Huckabee or possibly even an Obama, who are not known right now,
right,
the way they would be known and understood and,
right,
judged August or September.
Because the campaigns haven't been run yet.
Right. So, does McCain do better against the various Democrats because he's really going to do better if nominated, or because he's just a better-known quantity who's a little more moderate? Unclear to me.
One other little thing before you go, and it probably relates to the cell phones. We typically think of polling being done at night when people are home,
right,
eating dinner or afterwards. But I gather you told my producer that more polling is being done in the daytime than used to be done. Is that correct?
Well, sort of. There's certainly a lot of calling going on during the day. I think what we were talking about was a slightly different issue, whether there's too much calling going on during the daytime, because it by some pollsters for whom that cuts their costs a little bit. There's no reason you can't call during the day. The danger is if you call a number during the day, don't get an answer, and then can never come back to it for reasons that ought to be perfectly obvious. A lot of us aren't home during the day. Your point, though, is if we start to try to incorporate cell phones, or if we choose to incorporate cell phones into these samples, we're going to need to call at different times of the day. It might not necessarily be during the early evening hours. And then we have to think about what in the world are we interrupting when we call.
Mark Blumenthal runs the website pollster.com. That was very illuminating. Thank you very much.
Right.
I hope we can have you back.
Thank you, Brian. Hope so.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Coming up in a minute, we will look more closely at how race is emerging as an issue between Clinton and Obama. Stay with us.
Are you the one?